Blog Talk Radio.
Well, you may throw your rock, hide your hand, working in the dark against your fellow man. But as sure as God made black and white, what's done in the dark will be brought to the light. You can run on for a long time, run on for a long time, run on for a long time. Sooner or later, gotta cut you down. Sooner or later, gotta cut you down. Go tell that long-tongued liar, go and tell that midnight rider, tell the rambler, the gambler, the backbiter, tell him that God's gonna cut you down. Tell him that God's gonna cut you down. Tell him that God's gonna cut you down.
Well, welcome to Walls in Our Minds. This is Terry Dodd, and I'm here tonight with my co-host, Red Beckman, and Dr. Kate.
Dr. Kate is here. I'm waiting for Red.
Good. He said he might be a minute late. He got
here
in a little
is.
Bit late.
I'm here.
Right on time.
I'm here.
Right on time.
Yeah.
Well, since you're going to open the conversation tonight, I think I will go ahead and open us with a prayer. That is, if I can get, I'm going to just shut that off so that it won't be bothering me. For some reason, the BTR throws an ad up at the beginning of our show sometimes, and it did that and started playing in my ear. So I'm going to open us with prayer, and then Red, I'm going to turn the floor over to you to start our conversation out tonight, if that's okay.
Very good.
Almighty Father in heaven, we acknowledge you as the only one that can sustain us eternally. We believe that that's what your Son meant when he said, only you are good. Father, we acknowledge that you created this universe, and that when it's all said and done, the victory will be yours. We acknowledge your glory and your esteem and our need for you. So we ask you to fill us with your Spirit this night, to guide us in this show and everything that we do and say, and open the hearts and minds of our listeners, and just help us to have a productive conversation tonight. We want to talk a little bit about this judicial system and our grand juries, and we ask for your blessing on the people of this federation, of each of our states, that they might be treated fairly. But we also pray, Father, that you help us to educate people and that people will grow in knowledge, because we know that, as you said in your word, your people perish for lack of knowledge. And, of course, we recognize that what you mean by that is knowledge of you and your truth. We acknowledge you as the only source of truth, of real truth. So we pray all of this in the name of your Son, our Savior. Amen. Well, Red, you wanted to talk about grand juries tonight. I guess that's been something fresh on your mind this week, and you've had some conversations with some folks out there. And so start us out.
Well, you know, I have been talking grand juries for so many years. And it seemed like the only place where we had any real effect was in Montana. And I was just writing another ad for the America Free Press, and I mentioned how that in 1980, the Internal Revenue Service prosecuted five different tax cases, and they lost four of the five. And the one that they won was just a misdemeanor, and, of course, it was a railroad job, but there was an attorney that represented the defendant. And it was really a strange situation because the trial was in Butte, Montana Federal Court, and I was about 225 miles away or so in Billings, Montana. And so I left early in the morning, fairly early in the morning, because I wanted to be in that at that trial. But I thought, you know, the preliminaries and such, why that was not all that necessary that I be there. And I think it was probably about 10 o'clock or after that, 10 to 11 o'clock, when I got to Butte and found a place to park close to the federal building and made my way into the federal courthouse and up on the second floor, and everything, the place was just dead. I mean, it was like a morgue, and I went up there, and the doors were closed and locked on the courtroom, and so I went downstairs and got on a payphone and called one of the local people there that I knew would know what was happening. And when they answered the phone, why, they said, oh, we're all over here. Everybody's over here in our house. Come on over. And I said, well, what about the trial? Did they delay it or what? No. The whole trial was over. They started at 8 o'clock in the morning. They picked a jury. The government presented their case. The defense attorney went through the defense, and it was all over by 10 o'clock. Now, that's just 2 hours. And to pick a jury so I knew that this was a fishy kind of a deal. But anyway, that's the only case that we lost. In the IRS, as far as their prosecutions were concerned, in 1980. In the early 80s, and I cannot give you the exact years, but the IRS was unable to get, and the Justice Department, they were unable to get a single grand jury indictment against anyone in Montana for tax evasion. This is the first time anything like this has happened in the United States of America. And this was 1980. And we have all of this activity now. It's nationwide. They say that they have people working in every state now. They're trying to form common law grand juries. Well, they're not having too good a luck because they're not getting any cooperation by the local law enforcement and such, so they don't have the subpoena power. And I think, Terry, you're going to be able to talk about the subpoena power, because you know that quite well, and I'll let you talk about the subpoena power of the grand jury. But what I'm trying to say is this. Education, re-education, getting people to more or less recognize that they have been shortchanged in the government school situation, the government school education, they do not teach anything about grand juries. Of course, I've been out of high school for over 65 years. Already at that time when I went to high school, there was nothing in the curriculum having to do with grand juries. There was nothing to do with jury nullification. There was just nothing on jury trials and how that that's where we the people exercise our authority. And I'm saying that using that word authority because power goes with authority. The two are inseparable. And so I guess the first television program we ran in Montana We didn't cover the whole state with it, but it was in 1976. But then in 79, we produced a program right in the studio of one of our local television stations in Billings, Montana. We produced a program called People and Taxes. And we were making some noise in the media across Montana because I had been speaking out all across Montana. I was becoming acquainted with people of like mind and John Birchers, and there were pretty strong John Birch movement at that time. And, of course, they were the only source we had for any books or anything like what we needed for constitutional studies. And, of course, we started calling ourselves Americans for Constitutional Government. And it was, we were just feeling our way, you might say, because we really didn't have any kind of a template to follow. We had to fly by the seat of our pants, I guess you say, and we did that. And I was speaking all over Montana, and sometimes the group might be only 15 or 20 people, but then again, there were places where it would be 100 and sometimes even more. Of course, we had become pamphleteers, and I had written up quite a bit, and put it into flyers, and in fact, I even bought a printing press for printing these things, and we put out, a mass of information across Montana. Then we ran that program in 1979. In the spring, just before tax time, we ran the program. And, of course, we had such an advantage then. I think those programs at Billings only cost me about $750 to prime time, and we would preempt a regular program like, Gunsmoke and such. They let us preempt them. They'd charge us a little extra. But, you see, if we could preempt, like a program like Gunsmoke, or I don't remember all of the programs, but a popular program, we were assured of having an audience. There wasn't nobody had cable. There was no cable. There were no DVDs. There were no players, video players at that time. And of course, Billings, Montana had only two stations. And that's the most that any city had in the state of Montana at that time. And so we were secured in knowing that we had an audience. There was going to be an audience. The television station for weeks, they were inundated. Their telephones were just busy, 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 and they were totally amazed because they had never run any programming that generated the response from the audience. And, of course, that is music to a television station, that type of thing. And initially, there wasn't any station that would sell us time in the month of February, because that is rating month. That's when they try to put on programs that will draw an audience, because the rating services, February is one of the months where they do that. And so we had such a fabulous audience, and of course we had meeting then announced on the television. I announced a meeting in Billings, Montana, the next night at the Holiday Inn Convention Center, and we packed it out. I mean, we had a turnout, and 400 to 500 people came out, and we were reaching people with a message. And it had a big impact across the state of Montana. There were people talking about jury power. And so now here, 30-odd years later, we have people all over this country. They're talking about common law grand juries. Well, we've got a different situation today than we've ever had in this country in my lifetime. We have a population of people that are mad. They're unhappy. They're very, very upset with the way the politicians in Washington and the administrative branch of government, with all their rules and regulations and all these organizations like EPA and such. People are angry. We didn't have that much back in Montana in 1979 and 80. However, Montanans are a little bit more independent, and they've had a reputation, a history of electing some strong people for the Congress of the United States, the House and the Senate both. There's been an awareness, and of course, what people don't realize is that back there, before television, before iPods or whatever they call them, and Facebooks and all of that, people were reading. They were reading all kinds of different publications and books, and so it was a different mentality back then than what we have today. And so here we've got a nation of angry people, frustrated people. Frustrated is probably the better word. But if you get very frustrated without any solution, then you're going to get angry. And as I have said, when people get angry and they don't have the answers they need, they do get smarter pretty quick. You can teach them. You can re-educate them. You can deprogram the education that was implanted in the government school. You can deprogram those minds and get them to realize that they have been violated with propaganda and lies. And so anyway, we have a different political climate today. We have a different mentality on the part of the American people today. And so for me to hear and watch on the Internet what is happening with people, even in my home state of Montana, I had a friend back there call and say, hey, he says, we're going to have a meeting here. In Bozeman, Montana, he said, we're going to have a meeting here coming up Saturday. There's a guy that wants to organize a common law grand jury. Now, that's my home stomping grounds. That's where I grew up, in that county, in that area. And to have this happen, this kind of got my attention. And so this is happening all over the country. But I see myself back there 40 years ago. I was reading everything I could get my hands on. I read every book, I think, that the John Birch Society put out. I never would join the John Birch because I was a little bit, I was a little suspicious. I didn't Really, I didn't have much confidence in them, but I knew after reading some of the material that they did have some resources that had more value than anything I had been able to get my hands on. And so anyway, here we are. Back there after reading all that material, the Rockefeller file and none dare call it conspiracy and those different books, I was getting myself educated and I thought I was pretty smart. I thought I was so far ahead of everybody else, of course, all the family and friends and everything. And I thought I had a lot of answers. I look back now and I think, man, I didn't know anything. I was in kindergarten, Patriot kindergarten, and this is what we have right now today. They're organizing all across the East Coast, where that's been a difficult area for us to really gain any footing. With our truth, barrage, but Philadelphia. I had a call from Philadelphia, and the fellow here that called, he had met me in the past. I didn't remember him, but he had my phone number, and he called and wanted some information. Well, you see, They're angry to the point where they're beginning to do something, but they really don't understand how it has been stacked against us, how it has been put together by some real political gangsters. And that's why I thought we ought to do this tonight. Is get this information out there, and if it's archived, and if people, from around the country, if they hear about it, why, hopefully they'll get this the archives and hear what we've got to say, because I think we should be able to help these people get better grounded and know better as to how they need to operate. Now, I mentioned what we had happen in the early 80s in Montana when people figured out how it was supposed to work. But you see, that different world, where they didn't have all the access. They didn't have, let me say it this way, the major media wasn't near as propaganda oriented as it is today. Today it is just a total disaster, our major media. And this is something we have to overcome, and this is something that the people now that are really becoming activists and really trying to make things work, they're in a different world than I was back there in the 80s. So anyway, I've been going here for quite a while, and I think that Terry, I think you should now explain how that these people, some of them are running into some problems with the establishment, and you can. You can pick up here, and I'll be here, and I'll help put this together. And of course, Dr. Kate's there too. And of course, what Dr. Kate is doing in Western Montana right now, from what I'm hearing, it will be a very big surprise for me if there aren't some criminal indictments that are going to be returned by a grand jury in the state of Montana. And it might well be an educated federal grand jury put in place by the Justice Department, because I think this thing is big enough. I think Dr. Kate has done a great job there, and and she has, you know, defined the situation very well. And so I'll turn it back to you, Terry, right now.
Well, thank you, Red. Red, I have to credit you for the research, and a lot of even the people that we brought onto Walls in Our Minds and interviewed regarding the Fully Informed Jury Association. Obviously, we need to acknowledge you, Red, as being one of the people who inspired the formation of Fully Informed Jury Association. We've had Elo Jones on this show. We've had Roger Roots on this show, and others that are associated and have written about grand juries and studied the subject. When I first met you, Red, back in I guess it was 2008 or 2009, I had actually served as a petit juror prior to that, but really never really given a lot of thought to the responsibility, the great responsibility of judging the law as a juror. So my research really began in earnest after you explained the fact that our vote in the jury box is more powerful than our vote in the ballot box. And so it's been quite a journey from then until now for me regarding this topic, and I feel like I was where you were, and it was I didn't know beans back then, but now at least I have some idea of what I don't know. So I've a lot of people have looked to me to tell them about this topic, and it's forced me, as in all things, especially in studying scripture and things, you always become the best student when you become the teacher. The teacher has to study harder and know the topic more than anyone. So that has forced me to really study this topic. You talk about subpoena power, and I want to get to that. But I think we need to back up just a little bit and talk a little bit about pecking order and common law and what it means to be a common law jury as just to start as a foundational kind of thing. And we've talked about this topic so many times in the past, and I want to try to approach it in a little bit different way than we've approached it before. Where does a grand jury stand in the pecking order? Well, we've talked about the pecking order here before, being our Father in heaven, our Creator being the number one on the top of the pecking order, and the people being second in line. He gave us our unalienable rights. He's the one that granted those to us. And he also commissioned us to subdue and to take dominion. So it's the people that are second in line in the pecking order under the Creator. And then the people created the constitutions. So the constitutions, which are basically like trust agreements, they could be termed employment agreements of those that are in public service. So the Constitution is third under the people. And then the government is under the Constitution. And then all the other divisions of government and branches of government and statutory law and all of that sort of thing comes down there, down in the pecking order. But so where does a grand jury fall in this? You know, common law is something that's established really by the practice of the people. It's established over time. So many people come to me asking this question. In the last year, I've lost count of the people that have come to me that have said, "What are the rules of common law?" You know, and sometimes that comes out of the conversation of sovereignty. Well, the people are sovereign to the extent that we have the final say on the law, and we are second in the pecking order only to the Creator. So here we are, sovereign people being seated in a jury situation, And where does that fall in a pecking order? Well, juries are not created directly by the people. Juries are created by legislative act, and they serve under the auspices of a court. Well, the government is all the way down at fourth in this pecking order. So if they're the ones that legislate and create the courts and the juries, then the creation of the juries is somewhere down there under the pecking order of number four. But then you interject the people, sovereign people, into the jury, and they are free to judge the law. So there's a mixture of this pecking order in the juries. And the juries are there to really protect the people as much as they are to convict the people. So the people then actually operate under common law when they are properly seated as a juror. But it's not created under common law. But once they're seated in that capacity, they can function under common law because they're not bound by statutory law in their judgment of the law. They don't have to just judge the facts of the case. So there's this mixture of pecking order in the juries. But we have to recognize that in the absence of a court of competent jurisdiction, the jury, whether it's a grand jury or a petit jury, we should probably re-clarify what the difference is between those, because a petit jury makes a judgment of guilt. A grand jury only makes recommendations to a court as to whether or not there is probable cause to further prosecute and whether a crime has been committed and it's justified for prosecution. That's what a grand jury does, where the petit jury actually can judge the facts of the case and the law and determine whether or not a person should be found guilty of a crime. Under common law, and this is really, I believe, where the great downfall has occurred with those people impaneled on juries, is that they've completely lost track of, and because the education system, again, has failed us in so many ways, but the education system should be teaching people about common law. Well, under common law, if there's not a victim, there's not a crime. The first rule of common law really is very similar to what our Messiah taught us as being a summation of the law, and that is to treat your neighbor as you wish to be treated yourself, to love thy neighbor. That's really the essence of common law, and that's why if somebody hasn't been injured, if there's not a victim, then a person should not be committed of a crime. So to this extent, all juries serve under common law. So when you start talking about a jury formed by the people and they call it a common law jury, that really doesn't distinguish them, because anybody serving in a jury is in fact operating or functioning under common law, even though it's not created under common law. It's created under legislated law and under the auspices of a court. And it has to be that way because in the absence of a court, you can't enforce a subpoena and you can't enforce prosecution. So a grand jury by necessity functioned under the auspices of a court. But these courts have been lying to people. The judges have been misrepresenting the authority and the power of the juror. So they've been telling people, you can only judge the facts of the case. And if the people had a great understanding of common law, they would understand that they're walking in there as a sovereign person, a private living person, and they have every right to judge that law, and they have every right to determine whether or not a statutory law is a just law or not. So they can elect to acquit, to find somebody innocent, even if the facts of the case, Kate, that the person did what they're accused of doing. But in the absence of a court, that prosecution is never going to happen. You can't go to a sheriff and get him to prosecute a presentment because a group of people got together on their own and decided that somebody committed a crime. You've got to have the court there because, first of all, you can't force a hostile witness to come and testify for a grand jury. So you can't collect information from anybody that doesn't volunteer to come and provide information to that jury. So here we are in this situation now, and people are confusing this term, common law grand jury. Well, the fact that a jury is a common law does not mean that it is put together by people instead of by legislated act and by a court. It doesn't distinguish them. But the legislated jury system means that to try to circumvent that system, first of all, you're putting yourself into something that falls under the legislature, under the government, and the very people that are trying to do something here to hold people accountable are surrendering their position to be under the auspices of the government by even saying that they're a grand jury. They don't want to do that. You want to be able to be above them in all ways. You want to be fully sovereign with the full power of the people. Well, juries are regulated both by legislative act, which defines the tasks of that jury, but they're also regulated by the courts because it's up to the court to determine whether or not that jury has violated someone's rights. So it is by necessity that a jury falls under the auspices of a court. Now let's look for a minute at the Williams case, the 1992 Williams case, where so many people have misrepresented this. They've said that what Scalia said is that a common law grand jury is the fourth branch of government. Well, first of all, he didn't refer to it as a common law grand jury. He just said grand juries are the fourth branch of government, and he mentioned that they do function under common law. He didn't say they're formed under common law. He said they function under common law. He also said that the court, that they are free to operate because there's not a specific rule as to how these grand juries are to be supervised by the court. In fact, they have the right to investigate whatever they want to investigate. They can investigate the judge that called them and seated them and the court that gave them their oath of office. They can investigate that prosecutor. They can tell that judge and the prosecutor that formed that jury to get out of here. You don't tell us what to do here. You've seated us here, but now we're going to investigate what we want to investigate. You don't tell us we don't have the right to judge the law. They have every right to do that and act as sovereigns once they are seated. And that was all acknowledged pretty much by what Scalia said. But what people are saying is they're trying to turn it around and say that since he mentioned common law, and since he said the people are the fourth branch of government, we have the right to go out here and form a jury without the court. Well, first of all, you're in insurrection. You're in rebellion against the legislated system. Of judicial system that's been legislated. You're going against that. You have no authority to subpoena anybody, and you have no way of getting anybody to prosecute your presentments. A presentment being really an indictment, a self-generated indictment. The distinguishing factor of a presentment is that you were not given a bill of indictment by the judge or by the court. You decided that a crime had been committed other than what you had been told, and you want to investigate that, and you decide that someone deserves an indictment, so you put out what's called a presentment. So when I say presentment, I'm really talking about a self-generated indictment. So here's where we are, and feel free, either one of you, Dr. Kate or Red, to come in here and maybe help me to clarify this. I'm trying to approach it from a way that people can understand what Scalia was trying to get at. And if you really
I think I can help you, Terry. The people on the grand jury, they need to understand that they live, they exist, they perform, they produce under the common law, not under statute and legislative fiat or whatever. When they sit in that grand jury, the seventh article of the Bill of Rights, it's talking about a jury, the common law jury, but it says other than by the rules of the common law. Well, what are the rules of the common law? The basic foundation of the common law is the Ten Commandments. The Bible, the laws and rules and such in the Bible are all common law. And so the people on the that do get seated, they are not the judge, the prosecutor, the sheriff, and all of those, they all are under oath to uphold and defend the Constitution for the United States of America. Now, that means that they are to perform, as the Constitution has set it up for them. They are under the Constitution. The Constitution is above them, and basically the grand jury and the petit jury are to be selected in a mechanical process. The clerk of the court, the judge and all, they have a set of rules, and basically they're common law. I mean, they're not necessarily statute law. They need the statute law just as a guide, but it's just a guide for servants. The clerk of the court, they have this mechanics of picking a jury, and they take the names of the registered voters, and they draw them by lot, supposedly. And if they do it right, that's the way it's done. And, of course, then they send out the notices, and they send out the notices that such and such a day has been set aside for this trial or been set aside for the grand jury to meet, and where they meet and all of that. The people that do go through these mechanics of the process dare not do anything to interfere with the process, with the people that are going to actually do the investigation or the questioning and all of that. But if the grand jury, if they want to issue a subpoena, if they want to force somebody to appear, like when Bill Clinton was subpoenaed to the grand jury, here he is, the President of the United States, And he thought he could brush that thing off. He thought that his attorney general would be able to get that off of his agenda. And he found out that the grand jury is the higher power than he was, and they're a higher power than the attorney general. And so Bill Clinton had to comply with the subpoena. And this is all the mechanical end of this. This is not the administration or the, this is not the investigation. They cannot insert themselves in any way into the process of the grand jury or the petit jury doing their job and doing what they're supposed to do. And, of course, the common law is in the hearts and the minds of the jurors. And so when they get into the session, the biggest and the most important thing for them, I think, is that they understand that they are the higher power than the clerk of the court. They're a higher power than the judge. They're a higher power than the prosecutor. And they're the boss. And so that's where we're breaking down in the system, is the people sitting on the grand jury, sitting on the trial jury, do not have this grasp of the fact that they are in a position of authority. The only authority the clerk of the court has is to call that jury, do the mechanics of it, select the jury, by lot, the people that are to serve on that jury, and they notify. That's their job. It's an office, and they are equipped to send out these notices. And of course, like I say, they cannot interfere. They cannot, they don't have any reason to inject themselves into the activity, the actual work of the grand jury or the petit jury, either one. So I don't know if that has explained anything or not, but when they subpoena, they don't have to go out and serve this subpoena on Bill Clinton or whoever. It goes to the sheriff, and he does the mechanics of this. He goes out and finds the person and delivers a subpoena. And he's not going to affect the outcome of the trial or anything else. He's just going to do the legwork. He's the servant. He's a servant of the grand jury, the petit jury. He is the servant. The clerk of the court is a servant. The judge is a servant. And so that's the big thing that we have to overcome, is people thinking that they are under that judge, under the government. They're above it, and that's such a tremendous, such a tremendous difference than what we're trained or what they wanted us to be. They wanted us to be servants, their servants. Now, I don't know if I helped the discussion or not, so I'll go back to you, Terry, but I'd like to hear what Dr. Kate has to say tonight, too.
Well, and I was about to turn the floor over to her because she's got a thought on some of this.
Good evening, gentlemen, and everybody out there. Hi, Red.
Hi to you. Good to hear you.
Yeah, we've got quite a lot of snow and cold temperatures here, so.
That's what I hear.
Yes. Anyway. Okay, I've found this information very good, and Terry, just correct me if I'm wrong, and Red. So what basically you're saying from the from the pecking order and so forth is the properly formed grand jury is formed by legislature and by, say, a prosecutor and so forth. And what you're seeing happening, what you're commenting on is in some ways people are going outside of that system and forming common law grand juries, which are not underneath the proper structure, so that they really are not they can't enforce a subpoena or investigate or enforce a judgment. So what you have then, Ashley, and I know there's just so much corruption out there, and I take the Sheriff Arpaio investigation of Obama, for example. He developed enough information to take the case, request the prosecutor, and I don't think he requested the county commissioners, but request the county prosecutor to form a grand jury so that that information against Obama could be presented. But the prosecutor refused. So what I'm noting, we have so much corruption and so much of this malfeasance going on in our courts and with our prosecutors and so forth, with these bar attorneys. Is that corruption then forcing people to go out, for example, and form their own common law grand jury and just proceed along with presentments and so forth and so on? So that's the first question I have. Is that what you see happening?
There's no question, Kate, that the corruption in the system has been what has angered people and is forcing them to do something, to come together, to try to circumvent the corruption in the judiciary and in the Bar Association. I mean, basically, as Red has said many times, every federal judge is a criminal. They're all corrupt. None of them are serving the people. And when you hire an attorney, you're hiring an agent of the court. So you know it's a club, and there's very few of them who will even admit to you that in fact they're representing the court rather than any private person. And when only really a corporate entity can be represented in that way. A private living person would act on their own. They don't need any representation. So there's this great deception that's been going on, and it's been escalating. And the people that have come together for these people's or citizens' grand juries, which is a more proper term, a people's grand jury, if you will, they're to be commended for the fact that they want to take a stand, that they recognize something's wrong, and they recognize that they've got to come together to try to do something about it. The problem is that some of the people who have been encouraging them to do this have been misrepresenting the situation and bringing them in a point in the pecking order that they don't want to be, because the people above them in the pecking order are the very people they want to hold accountable. So there's no way they're going to get these people to cooperate with their presentments. The other thing is that a grand jury is limited in its scope. It's clearly defined. So the whole concept of putting together a group of people outside the auspices of a court to form a grand jury is a mistake. And it could even land some people in jail. And in fact, it has in the past. This is not new. This has been tried over the last 12 years, and it's the result has been the same in every case. They have never achieved prosecution. They've never been able to call a hostile witness, and they have no ability to prosecute or force redress of any grievance. But it is mandatory that people rise up against this corruption, and you're absolutely correct. The corruption is what is forcing them to do these things. But they need to understand, yes, they need to come together. They need to form a board of review or they call it whatever you want. You call it a Citizens Accountability Council, and in your respective county or your state, and you can look at it. There's information out there. I don't want to get into the specific documents that we put online, but I will refer people to the website.
And I just like to stop you there. Before you go there, I just have a couple other questions, because that was going to be my next issue, if you don't mind, because I'm a great fan of just trying to do this in order so that we don't confuse the whole thing. So basically, at that level where we're dealing with corrupt prosecutors and legislators and county commissioners, there are standard avenues, right? You diselect the guy, you recall the county commissioners, you do all of that stuff. But as we found, the political system and the bar attorneys and so forth, they just got it locked down, so it is nearly impossible to do recalls, except, I guess, if you live in Colorado. And the election process and so forth, are those the only avenues that people within, you know, within the proper system, grand juries, people who are concerned about that corruption, aside from setting up these separate things, what avenues are there to deal with that corruption? And then I want to go to the next question. So if you could address that.
I might need for you to repeat the last thing you said, because my Skype kind of went haywire on me, and I did not hear the last little bit of what you asked.
Yeah, sure. You tell that to everybody. It was my most important question. No, I'm just kidding you. What I'm saying, basically, we agree that corruption is driving people to do this, to do a form of people's grand jury or people's common law grand jury that may put them in jeopardy because it's outside of, quote-unquote, the system that's been developed to be under the legislative auspices and the auspices of the courts. So if you're in that situation, and I was giving the example of the Arpaio situation where the prosecutor refused to call a grand jury, then the customary avenues for taking care of that are recall, diselection, and so forth. Is that right, or are there other customary avenues?
Yes, there are.
Inject something here?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Inject something?
Go ahead, Red. Go ahead, Red.
I wasn't complete in my thought before, and it didn't dawn on me until I was listening to you, Dr. Kate and Terry, and going on. I said that the people, what we really have to overcome is the people on the grand jury and on the petit jury. It's difficult to get them to understand that they are above. They are above the sheriff. They're above the county clerk and recorder. They're above the prosecutor. They're above the judge. Well, that's just half of the story. You see, we've got the sheriff, the judge, the prosecutor. We've got all those people, and they have been on top. They've been above us for so long. And so when we pick ourselves up by our bootstraps and get ourselves up where we belong in this order of authority or pecking order, it's rather painful for those that are going to have to step down off of their platform where they have become so accustomed. And, of course, we have to remember that, see, all of those people, including the judge and the sheriff and everybody, they all went to the same government schools that the rest of us went to. And so they have to be re-educated. They have to be re-educated to the point where they recognize that they you know, they talk about being public servants, but all the time they're being public servants, why they want to sit on a throne. And we just, you know, that's got to be reversed. And so this is what we're talking about. And, of course, you were talking about, we were talking about corruption. And the federal judges and state judges are the same way, have become so so free that they can do all kinds of things. Now, I just found this. It just came to my attention here within the last couple of weeks. This is part of a transcript. I'm going to read this because I think it's vital where we're at in this discussion. I hadn't thought about it here until now, listening to the two of you talk and all. But this is in black and white, and it comes right out of a court transcript. You know, the court clerk is, you know, it's, this is the court clerk's job, is to take these comments down by the judge and the defendant and the attorneys and all of that and get it into a transcript. Well, here's what the court said in this one case, and this comes from 2004. The judge is talking. He says, I will say, I think, you know, Colonel, the guy that was the defendant or the prosecutor or the plaintiff, I don't know which, he was a retired Army colonel. He says, I will say, I think, you know, Colonel, I have to tell you that there are cases where a long course of history, in fact, does change the Constitution. Did you hear what I said?
Yeah.
I'm going to read that again. I have to tell you that there are cases where a long course of history, in fact, does change the Constitution. And I think of one instance. I believe I'm correct on this. I think if you were to go back and try to find and review the ratification of the 16th Amendment, which was the Internal Revenue Income Tax, I think if you went back and examined that carefully, you would find that a sufficient number of states never ratified that amendment. He goes on, and nonetheless, I think it's fair to say that it is part of the Constitution of the United States, and I don't think any court would ever set it aside. Well, I've seen that. I've seen somewhere a treatise on that, and I think it was. I think I'm correct in saying that actually the ratification never really properly occurred. The court goes on, yet nonetheless, I'm sure no court's going to say that the amendment permitting income tax is void for any reason, although I wouldn't mind filing for a rebate myself. Now, these judges have been changing the Constitution, haven't they? And here we have the admission right there. This is where, you see, we've got to get some grand juries functioning. This is why the people out here are so frustrated. They're trying anything. They're trying to back the government down with their threats of the common law grand juries. They're trying to back them down off of their high post and put them back in the status where they're a slave or a servant. And it's just, this is what's going on. And so we the people This is where I'm a, you know, I think the movement for establishing common law grand juries is probably they've got the cart ahead of the horse or something, because the first thing they've got to do is get the American people to realize that they are the sovereigns, not that judge. He is a servant. He gets paid from tax money. He's got a conflict of interest if it's a, if it has anything to do with taxes. Now, you see, this is why, you see, we need a properly constituted grand jury that will take on the court system and say, why or where did you get the authority to change the Constitution? And they'll say, oh, we didn't do that. Well, we got a transcript here, an official transcript from a federal court in down in one of the Carolinas, I think it was, that says that they have changed the Constitution. Well, most of us that have been around any length of time know that that has happened. And so, you know, it's a bad situation that we've got, but we're going to have to do what we can and do everything we can to bring us back and get those people, you know, demoted back down to where they're servants again, and we the people are sitting on our thrones as kings in our castles. So wait a minute, I've got information that indicates that we may have a grand jury that will be a properly constituted federal grand jury that's going to take a look at the Obama birth certificate that was issued out of the White House as the official, and it's been proven by many people that it's a fraud. Well, that's a crime. And, you see, we're going to see what happens now. There's supposed to be a commitment by a judge and a prosecutor to bring it to a grand jury. So we'll have to wait and see if they make it work. We'll be watching that very close.
Okay, so thank you, Red, very much for that, and I want to look at that very closely as well. So what I hear you saying is that, number one, as Terry, you said from the beginning, my people perish for lack of knowledge, is that we've been all dumbed down in the government schools, so we don't know we are the sovereign. We don't know the extent of our own powers. Now, when we do know that, we are faced with a system that is absolutely 100% corrupt. And people with conflicts of interest, people with who are changing the Constitution through case law, the Constitution is not a living document and can be changed like that. So the answer is, which you eloquently expressed, Red, was that everybody needs to be re-educated. Now, I'm sure they're not building those FEMA camps for judges. They're building them for us. But given that the tremendous amount of re-education needs to happen on all kinds of levels, and yes, we do have pockets where there are properly seated grand juries that seem to have the correct systems in place, and we need to make sure we support those areas, I think. What we are stuck with now is the prospect of re-education, which needs to happen, and the constant fighting against a corrupt system. And it just occurred to me as this time, because I know, Terry, you've been talking about boards of review, and I've been so busy here, I haven't really had a chance to look at it. Now I think I begin to see where the board of review comes in, because we need to hold officials accountable We need to start making that voice be heard. We need to start taking our power back so that eventually we can get back to a properly seated grand jury the way the founders initially indicated. That's going to take a lot of rooting out. So I'd like to just shift a little bit because you had started this, but I wanted to sort of lay a framework. And in the process, I think I now am beginning to see why now a board of review. We do have these properly seated grand juries. We are facing a lot of corruption. There are a few pockets of success. We know that people need to be reeducated, but we've still got this accountability issue of these officials running wild. They all need to be in jail. I guess I saw a poster that said, you know, I'm for two terms of senators, of representatives, one in their seat and one in jail. And so, because by the time they serve one term, they've violated enough laws to throw them in jail. So I think that's right. But anyway, am I moving in the right direction, Terry? Is this where the Board of Review comes in terms of, if you will, sort of a segue back to a constitutional system? Is that how you see it, or can you help me frame in where a Board of Review comes in here?
I see the Boards of Review as being the only way at this point that the grassroots can come together and rise up and express their unalienable rights of life, liberty, and property without interfering with or rebelling against the existing legislated system. It is the way to come in at the second pecking order under only the Creator and holding those people accountable that are lower down in the pecking order. It is really the only way. Now, you can call it many things. The only thing you can't call it is a grand jury, because a grand jury is a defined legislative institution. You asked
a
question
a
while ago about recall and about, you didn't mention it, but there's a lot of people trying to do ballot initiatives. And ballot initiatives are a good avenue to try to straighten things out, because it puts it to the vote of the people. But let me give you an example of a problem. Again, we've all been so dumbed down. I mean, we have to each one admit that. The first thing we have to admit is that we don't know it all. But we've got to start digging. We've got to educate ourselves in the way that we have been, and really re-educate ourselves, because we've been uneducated. We haven't just been not educated. They've propagandized us. They've changed our perceptions to not even know what our rights are anymore or what our power is as people. One of the first things that a grassroots group needs to do when they come together is learn how to be a juror. But more importantly, they need to really understand how to exercise their sovereignty under common law. In other words, there has to be a self-governance there that you're not going to go out and violate other people's rights. But also, let's just give a ballot initiative for an example here. A very good, well-intentioned person here in Colorado wrote a ballot initiative, and my question to him was, why would you want to ask for the majority vote on your rights? Now think about that for a minute. The ballot initiative that he wrote was basically asking for one of his own unalienable rights. Why would you want to put your unalienable right to a vote of the majority? You don't. It's unalienable. It's a right. It's not a privilege. It's a right. So we've got to educate these people, and the grassroots need to come together, and they need to begin to educate each other. There's some of these people that are forming these citizens grand juries, for example, who have been going to these law groups, and they've learned pretty well how to be a juror. They're a pretty fully informed juror. But there's a lot of other things that they've been misled about that they don't understand, like the fact that they shouldn't go out and try to form a grand jury without the auspices of a court. It's a waste of resource, and it could get you into trouble. So this educational process really, in my mind, is a part of the duties of a board of review. If people come together and they form a board of review, they need to recognize that they've got to do a lot more than just hold the people who are doing wrong and are violating their oaths of office out there. There's a lot more to it than just holding them accountable. They first got to educate themselves, and they've got to also recognize that there's a lot more that they can do. They can write ballot initiatives. They can issue writs themselves. They don't have to rely on these corrupt courts. A grand jury, all a grand jury can do, even if it's a seated grand jury, is to make a recommendation to a court. Well, we don't want to be going and relying on those corrupt courts. We want to be able to rely on the power of the people. So the people have got to not just rise up and take a stand. They can't just do whatever they want. That's the other thing that some of these people that are forming these citizens' grand juries are telling people. We're the people. We have the ultimate power. We can do whatever we want. Well, you know, tell Schaefer Cox that. You know, Schaefer didn't do anything, and he's put in jail. And if you go out here and you take on these people and you rebel against an existing system, they can actually send the sheriff after you and lock you up if they think you're disturbing the peace or doing an insurrection, which in essence you are. But if you come together as a board of review, that's not a legislated, defined entity. You can file your charter. You can bring the people together. You can have an election in your county and select a board yourself. And then you've got to follow the law. You can't just go out there and do whatever you want to do. You've got to be responsible. You've got to bring respect to that office. You've got to go out there and make people understand that what you're doing is to the benefit of the people, that you're not trying to rebel or insurrect or abolish anything. You're just wanting them to follow their oaths of office and the constitutional law that's there, because that's been established by the people.
Okay, let's go back. Sorry, go ahead.
No, I can keep going, but I'll follow your questions.
Yeah, let's just go back a little bit there. Okay, so we've established what's wrong right now with the grand jury system. It really is the corruption, but inherently there's nothing wrong with it. That was designed properly by our founders and so forth and so on, but it is hopelessly corrupted right now. Well, let's just say it's corrupted right now, and the people and everybody are completely uneducated about it. So the going out to the citizens' grand jury and all of that could be viewed as an insurrection. So the next avenue, what you're talking about, is the board of review. How could that not be viewed as insurrection? Where does the authority come from?
By the people acting responsibly.
No, that's not exactly. That's not exactly the question that I'm asking. Is that say you form a board of review? Why couldn't a judge, a grand jury, a prosecutor, any lawyer, why couldn't they call that insurrection itself, forming a board of review? So in other words...
Well, you can't stop
people. Hang on. There are two questions here. One is again, the authority for the board of review and where that comes from and why that would not be an insurrection. But, you know, we have this question that people are going to label whatever. And the second question is this, is given this confusion even about the jury system, the grand jury system, how does one propose to get people to understand a board of review as an interim step to getting back to the right system, or as a necessary step right now? So those are two questions there.
Well, first of all, we put an essay online at asoi.us that people should go and read. And don't just read it once. Read it three or four times.
Don't send me to – I know we have to go do that reading, but what I'm asking you now is to explain where
authority
comes from and so forth.
I'm just trying to give people a shortcut to getting a better understanding of this, because it's not simple for people to grasp, because they've completely lost scope of what their power is.
Right.
So they need to read that essay. But what I'm going to tell you is that a board of review has no more right than an individual, except that you're operating in a collective. In other words, it comes with more force if you are an organized group and you filed your charter and you've made it clear what your group represents and you've put people on notice and you properly seat that board of review. And all of that's right there in the essay and in the sample charter that we put at asoi.us. So I'm not going to try to reinvent that wheel here. But the fact of the matter is that we don't get these rights from a constitution. We don't get these rights from any legislated body. These are inherent, unalienable rights that we have to hold these people accountable, because we are second in the pecking order. We've been given these rights by our Creator. So it's critical for people to understand you're not going to find a document that says a board of review has certain rights or certain authority or certain power. It carries the full authority of the people, who are second in the pecking order only to the Creator. But you do have to follow the law. You do have to not try to abolish that which has been legislated properly. You need to be responsible and not step on other people's rights. You need to follow the common law with this. So is it going to stop somebody from making an accusation? I can accuse you of anything I want. I can file suit against you for anything I want, whether you've done it or not. They put people like Schaefer Cox in prison, and he hasn't done a blessed thing to break a law. I mean, if he did, it wasn't what they prosecuted him for. So, I mean, yes, there's always a battle that's going to go on here. Yes, there's going to be resistance. That's why you don't want to try to do it alone. That's why you want to go out there and get two dozen people together, 25 if you can get them in your county or your state, and make sure that those are responsible people, people that are not going to go out there and do stupid things and say stupid things to the press or accuse a sheriff that he's trying to set up an assassination on you when the guy's really not even a bad guy. You know, if you've got people on a board of review that are going to want to go out there and act irresponsibly, you're going to do no better than these phony citizen grand juries, because they're going to be shot down because they marginalize themselves from being irresponsible. A board of review, in my mind, needs to build a relationship with the constitutional sheriff, and if there's not one, you get one elected. A board of review needs to go out there and build a relationship with their board of county commissioners or board of supervisors, or whatever they're called in your local area. A board of review needs to know who their town council members are. They need to reach out to the community. They may even need to inform people as to why it's important to have a well-regulated militia. There's all of these things that a board of review needs to do, but what it doesn't need to do is go out there and shoot itself in the foot, just like these people are doing with these phony grand juries. Down in Florida, look at the example. These people went in, they didn't go in, they didn't even, the commissioners didn't know who they were at the town council or whatever it was they went to, and they demanded that they give them money and a budget and a room, and they had built no rapport. And they had no authority to do what they were doing, and they didn't even have a specific purpose laid out for what they were doing. It is a function of responsibility. If you're going to take the responsibility on to serve on a board of review and to organize it, you've got to do these things. You got to educate people. You got to slow them down enough they don't do stupid things. So that's where, if your community recognizes that this group of people are responsible, upstanding citizens in their county or state, and they are working together so that it's not just some rogue individual out there. You're not just going to take on one person. You're taking on two dozen people. And you might be taking on 100 people that put them in that position. Because if you can get the organization together and you get the support of the people and you have a county assembly there that actually elects those 25 people, man, you've got some power. But people can't be doing stupid things. They can't be spouting off to the press that I'm a sovereign citizen and I can do whatever I want. That's what they're telling people out there, and it's stupid. So I'll come back to your question. Did I answer your question?
Yeah, and I'll just tell you just what I just the surface thing is. You're just replacing one system. You're replacing one system, and I kind of would like to hear from Red on looking at both of these ideas, given the context of what we've been talking. What's your take on this, Red, and Board of Reviews, juries?
The Board of Review, there is a precedence because it was part of the Magna Carta, and Magna Carta was not put away out of sight and all of that by the founders. The Magna Carta still has force in our law, and so it has precedence, and it has a potential of getting people together enough to where you can have people studying and researching and discovering where we have been misled and miseducated and all of that. And one of the things that they really need to do is to pamphleteer, because that is, it's within their reach. And of course, you see, Terry, I think you need to tell people how to access that one program in particular on Google that you have watched a number of times, I think you said, and get that education that's available on that videotape. It's a videotape that I did in 1993 in Southern California for an organization there. And the Fully Informed Jury Association, they still say that that is the best teaching tape available out there today. I would highly recommend that people access all this kind of stuff. There's a half a dozen of my TV programs on there on that Google, and it's so simple, to bring it up, and just about everybody's got a computer, and they know what I'm talking about when I say Google, and I guess I'll just tell them how to do it. I've never done it myself. I have to
Red,
admit that. But
Red,
what?
Red, just go to YouTube.
Go
to YouTube and enter Red Beckman Seminar Full. Now, you can find short versions of this at Fija. Fija's actually got it on their website. But if you go to YouTube, and put in Red Beckman Seminar Full, it'll bring up, and you'll see it'll either be like an hour and a half, 2 hours long. And Red looks a lot younger there than he does now. But he does a great job of explaining the rights of a juror and the pecking order and what people really need to understand to turn this thing around. Because acting as a juror and acting as a person on a board of review is – a different situation, because a board of review has a lot more scope and a lot more authority and it answers to nobody but the people. So, but learning that pecking order and understanding, you know, that you have the right to judge the law is critical to all of this. And Red's right. That seminar is a must for anybody who doesn't already understand that. If you're not a fully informed juror, and whether you are or not, go look at Red Beckman's seminar, the full version, because it's worth your time. Go ahead, Red.
Well, it's just, you know, it's over 20 years, and of course now that, well, there's several. There's one that we did in in Sturgis, South Dakota, just back about 5 or 6 years ago. That is a very good tape, and I don't know how many different websites have picked up on these. You know, I was just amazed. Today I was working in my shop, which is a couple hundred yards away from our home here, and I've got an old radio there, and I turned that thing on, and I heard a couple of people. I don't know who they were. I don't know who they represented or anything else. And my goodness, talk about people talking about getting back to the Constitution and getting our country straightened out. I couldn't believe my eyes, or my ears, I should say, because, you know, this is such a thrill to me. People have sent me emails and said, well, I saw one of your videos on the email or whatever, on the computer, and you see, this is educational material that's available to everybody if they've got a computer, and I just hope that a lot of people out there will access this information. The boards of review, we didn't have boards of review in Montana, but we had the same effect. I always tried to keep from really starting a big brouhaha or anything. Back about 1983, I went and took the U.S. attorney out for lunch, and I wasn't a bit hesitant about going up and talking to him. And in fact, the predecessor of the one that I went to lunch with, he quit. He quit the job. He was the senior assistant U.S. attorney in the state of Montana, and then they put him in the top position in the interim between administrations, the Jimmy Carter and the Reagan administration and such, and he was acting U.S. attorney for several months. And I would go up and talk to him, and he up and got rid of his bar associate. He got out of there, out of the Justice Department. I don't know if he ever got a pension or anything, because I don't think he had 20 years in. But he got away. He figured that we were going to shake up the whole system and put it back on track. And he got rid of his bar association membership and bought a bar in Butte, Montana. But when I had lunch with the U.S. attorney, we went to this cafe in downtown Billings, Montana, that had the old style, pretty much privacy booths, with the partition between the booths going all the way to the ceiling, and it was a unique place. And we slid into the booth, and the first thing he said, I don't know, Red, but he said, even your detractors speak highly of you. Now, I'm not saying that bragging. I'm saying that because this is something that is so valuable that we maintain a solid common sense approach. Let's not become rabid about what we're doing. Let's set the standard for decency. We'll set the standard for decency because there's no decency much in the way the government is functioning. The different agencies and the different bureaus. We've got to hold the high ground, and the boards of review can be a tremendous education. Just a facility for people to get together and compare notes and bring in some specialists to explain what they think and what they know, and it can be a real growth thing if it's used properly. But you don't dare let somebody get in the driver's seat that's got an axe to grind and wants to use the boards of review for their personal vendetta or something against the system. And so you've got to be careful on that. And I guess I've said my two cents worth. Other than I'm thinking about Schaefer Cox and his predicament. And I mentioned it in my next AFP ad, how that they need funds for an appeal. But you see, if we get our grand juries functioning properly, the prosecutor and the judge in Schaefer Cox's what they have done to him, the judge and the prosecutor and the FBI, we need some indictments of these people because they've got a conflict of interest to do what they did, and they've got their pensions and their medical plans and their big vacations and everything that they're trying to protect. And Schaefer Cox was trying to make the corrections so that they earn their money properly and honestly. They don't want to do that. And I would like to see that judge and that prosecutor and the FBI or whoever it was that pulled that stunt, that they be indicted by a grand jury and go to trial with an informed jury. Those FEMA camps, Dr. Kate mentioned those. Man, I think those FEMA camps might come in real handy where we can rehabilitate a bunch of bureaucrats and judges and prosecutors. We can rehabilitate them there if we can get them back down to the level where they belong. So I'll turn it back to you to I've said about enough tonight, so back to you, Terry. Or Dr.
Are
Kate,
you
are
muted?
You there?
Yes, Terry, are you
muted?
Yeah, I must have been muted. I'm sorry. Let me just real quick tell people we got about 20 minutes, and I'm going to have Kate take the floor, but I wanted to let everybody know, please call in if you've got questions, if you've got a comment. We got about 20 minutes left. We'd love to hear from you. So 347-838-9176.
And press 1.
Yes, hit a 1 so Kate knows to give you a live mic. Go ahead,
okay,
Kate.
Okay, just very quick. Thanks, Red, for explaining that. I have heard people who want to form these boards of review and go immediately to arrest, and without the necessary steps as far as education and where we've been and so forth. So I'm relieved to hear that the board of review process is much more deliberative than that. But we've got those people out there who think but you can take a board of review and immediately turn to arrest of individuals. So that's very quick, not thinking all the way through. The second piece of this is that some of those same people say that once we form our board of review, then we become a grand jury. And I don't think that's what we're talking about here. So that's the second point. And again, feel free to correct me if I'm wrong. And then the third point, I would like to see that happen with Schaefer Cox as well. Outstanding young man and unfairly prosecuted, and all of the people who put him where he is right now really should be prosecuted. And I heard the word grand jury mentioned, and I'm back to the same place where it's so corrupt. How are we going to get a grand jury to get those guys? So in Schaefer Cox's case, is there an intermediary step where a board of review steps in to handle that situation? So those are my couple of questions, and then I'm done for this evening.
You asked so many, I don't know where to go back to now.
Okay, I guess the first was a comment that you've got board of review people who want to set up a board of review and move immediately to arrest.
The board of review needs to, in its rules, it should establish its own bylaws. If somebody in that board of review goes out and does something that puts an adverse condition on that board of review, or diminishes its recognition or its reputation, the board should have the ability to remove that person immediately from the board of review, and let the world know that they were dismissed. Those rules need to be clear. You know, it's also a matter, I've done a lot of small group work. And if you want people to be open and honest and be accountable to a group, there has to be a reasonable level of discretion and secrecy for certain things. A board of review should have that atmosphere. You should be able to sit down with those people and trust that if you discuss something, that they're not going to go out and blab it to the press until the board elects to put out a statement. I mean, this is the kind of responsible action that we need. We need responsible citizens in these positions, not just people who have enough guts to stand up. I mean, that's important that they have courage, but one of the reasons for doing a board of review is so that that courage can be spread out amongst the people, and you know you've got people to back you up. But one person should not go out and do anything on their own. If you look at Article 61 of the Magna Carta, it says that each of their basic, like, subcommittees, if you will, it doesn't call it that, but that's basically what they are, is a four-person panel. So that If you want to investigate something, let's say somebody brings a complaint to you, because a board of review is supposed to accept complaints and investigate it. Now, to that extent, they are acting in some ways like a grand jury, but they should never call themselves a grand jury. They just need to go out and do the investigation to verify that the complaint is legitimate before the board of review takes a position on it or takes action on it. But it calls for a four-person panel or committee to go and gather the information for a specific complaint and come back and report to the larger board of review. The recommended number for the board of review is 25. So at no time should one person be acting and acting as though they are acting on behalf of the board of review. Is that clear?
Yes. And
question number two.
The second point was what you just said. Do not call yourself a grand jury, and you do not morph into a grand jury.
Absolutely not. Then you're right back to your rebellion situation, and you're usurping an established legislative institution.
Right.
You don't want to go there.
And if you don't want to ask for permission for your unalienable rights to form a board of review, you don't put that on a ballot initiative.
Exactly.
Okay.
And you assume that power and authority, And you back it up yourself. And if somebody has to be arrested eventually, the people got to be willing to bring that off. Eventually, they're going to recognize why the Second Amendment says that a well-regulated state militia is necessary for the security of a free state. And when they recognize that, some people in that Board of Review might just want to go out and start, you know, working with the sheriff and getting the local people to put together, a Citizens Homeland Security Association. I know some people have problems with that term now because it is a demon in our government. But point is that, you know, if you want to put together a committee of correspondence they called it committee of correspondence or a committee. They had different committees back at colonial time that basically served this purpose. And, at some point we really need to reinstate our militias as well as our sound money. So those are things that the Board of Review can work on in addition to accepting complaints and working on writs and orders and things like that and holding the public officials accountable in a proper and lawful manner.
Okay. In the third question, in the context of the corruption that we've been talking about tonight, would a Board of Review be able to, when Schaefer's appeal is granted and he's out of there, is given the corruption that's been up there in Alaska and so forth, would a Board of Review be the proper avenue to get justice for him in terms of making those officials who threw him in jail accountable?
It would certainly lend a power to what's going on up there. If they had 3,500 or 10,000 or however men they had in that peacemaker militia up there, it would behoove them to start forming boards of review in every county with some of those, more responsible ones in out of that group. And they could have a lot of power up there if they had a board of review in a bunch of counties and then formed a state board of review out of that. We have formed an advisory board, an international advisory board is being formed right now for Schaefer to oversee and to bring resources together for his legal, it's called the Free Schaefer Cox Liberty Defense Fund. So we actually had the first official meeting of the board last night, and we're going to be adding some members to that. But they're talking about having a statewide board and a local board from where he's at, and hopefully those boards that are specifically working on that subject, it would be great if they had boards of review established in the counties and state up there that they could take this complaint to and then have them start investigating. That would be very, very powerful, Kate, and absolutely it is an avenue that should be pursued. But right now we've just got to act on this appeal. We can't wait on anything. So we've got the attorneys lined up ready to work on Schaefer's case. We just need a little bit of a donation, $10 a head, whatever. Go to the Free Schaefer Cox .com site and hit the donate button and give whatever you can give. I don't care if it's $5. We really need to put together $40,000, $50,000 pretty quickly.
Thank you very much. Like I say, I had just kind of a real mind opening this evening with this discussion, so I greatly appreciate all of this discussion. Thank you.
Wow, we've got 12 minutes left and nobody's called in. We must be covering the topic so well that nobody has anything to say. I don't believe that. I sure wish one of our other Montana Mountain women would call in here. We had a question from Singh, who is one of our regular listeners from down in Australia, down under, regarding is the Magna Carta mentioned in the Constitution? Red, would you like to take that, answer that question? He's wanting to know what relevance does it have to U.S. law?
No, I don't think it is. I can't, I right off the top of my head, I don't think it is. But you see, the Articles of Confederation, and they were in effect before the Constitution, and they were not discarded. They were not thrown in the trash. And Magna Carta, of course, was not thrown in the trash. Magna Carta has great value for us today. because they understood and their history, the history of the British Empire then, is something that we really need to be have our minds refreshed periodically with the history there. You see, the part that really fascinates me is how that when the barons, when they wrote the Magna Carta and asked the King John to sign it, he said no, and they made war. They were dead serious. They weren't going to take a no out of King John, and they had come to that point. And, of course, we don't know how much struggle there was ahead of time, preliminary, but I'm sure there was some. And so they made war. They caught the old king at the Battle of Runnymede and held him on the points of their sword, and they said, sign it or you die. And he signed it. And it's always fascinated me how that the Pope, England had been a Catholic nation up to that point pretty well, and the Pope, when he found out that King John had come under this law that made him a servant, and the people became the kings and queens in their castles, the Pope was up. He was upset. He was perturbed, and he told King John, he said, that's no good, that's not right, because you have a divine right to be king. And of course, that was the birth of the, that brought about the birth of the Church of England. There was no less than 40, over 40 times between 1215 A.D., and 1776, when the Declaration of Independence was signed, in those years, you see, a little over five, about 5.5 years or so, there was over 40 times where the kings of England tried to get pass Magna Carta and make it, you know, discard that law. There was 23 times that the people of England had to take their swords and bring the king and his forces back under the law, under Magna Carta. In just that, you know, about 550 years roughly. And so we have every reason in the world to really become upset when our government tries to do this gun control thing. And of course, it amuses me at this point, because every time that they go for another effort, try to take our guns and such, every time the American people, they respond. They don't make a big deal out of it. They just go down and buy more guns and ammunition. And somehow or other, our politicians just don't seem to get the message. How many times has this happened in just the last several years here, where every time they make a big push to get more gun control, the people go down and they clean the gun stores out of the guns and the ammunition. Ammunition is difficult to come by sometimes right now because the people are stockpiling the weapons and the ammo. And so Magna Carta secured the right. They knew that the people had to have the right to take up arms against the government if they didn't stay within the law. We don't need that today. Someone in the freedom movement has taken the word jury and revolution and put them together, and they say we've got a jury revolution. That's a lot better than a gun shooting revolution. and we can do a better job, and we don't have to destroy. You see what's going on over in the Ukraine and the buildings burning and people getting hurt and all. A jury revolution is what we need. That's, I'm talking about grand juries and trial juries. We need them both. And so we're about run out of time here. I better calm down here. So it's all yours,
Jerry. No, you're doing fine. You're doing fine. We got about 5 minutes left. Kate, anything else you'd like to comment here before I try to close this out?
No, I just, again, think this is a terrific discussion this evening and has laid out, I think, a very good foundation for people to understand how much and how far we need to go to be educated, the role of what a board of review could be while we continue to work on eliminating the corruption of our current system, finding those places where juries are properly seated and working with good officials, non-corrupt officials, if there can be found. So I appreciate this discussion. I thought it was great. Thank you.
One comment in the chat again by Singh is that the Board of Review can only apply pressure. Singh, if you read Article 61 of Magna Carta, you will find out that pressure can be extremely severe. It can, in fact, be just as severe as a sentence that can be laid out by a jury or a court. You can take it as far as the people have the courage and will to take it, because, in fact, the people do have the power, the ultimate power. Any right that that has been, you know, given or enumerated to the government, a board of review can actually carry out if no one else is doing their job or following their oath of office. It can be very severe as to the consequences of people not being responsive to a board of review. A board of review is fully capable of even removing people from office. It is not mob rule, Singh. It is not mob rule at all, because you're talking about an elected group of people. You're talking about a group of people who are acting responsibly and acting within the law. For example, let me give you an example. If they find that a breach their oath of office, they can file criminal charges against them, formal criminal charges against them. You know, they can file suit against them in civil court as well. But beyond that, they can make it known to the general public that they are violating their oath of office and have them removed from whatever other means is possible, whether it's a recall or just forcing them to resign or, you know, working to the next election. But there's many, many routes that can be taken lawfully without being any kind of mob rule. So trust me. To be done. Red, you got about 2 minutes here. I opened us in prayer. How about you close us in prayer?
I would be more than happy to. Heavenly Father, we thank you because we still have this freedom to work towards bringing back lawful government. And we thank you because we haven't gotten into a bloody revolution in this country. And we're thanking you because I'm sure that is not something that you would like to see. I'm sure you are not a part of bloody revolutions if you can help it. And we need to be working to bring about, you know, put a reputation out there of the people in the freedom movement, that we have integrity, that we have respect, we have honesty and all of that on our side of this thing. And the corruption in government, those people, we need to expose their corruption. We need to expose it publicly, to where the people out here recognize what has happened to them, and then that we might just have some answers to help them to know how to bring about the corrections that we need without having to have a bloody revolution. I remember writing in one of my books in the past, I said, a bloody revolution is the evidence of failure. And we don't want to fail. We can do this and do it in an honorable and a fashion and a proper way, a way that you would be pleased that we do it properly, bring about a correction, the corrections that we need in our system. We need your input. We need your wisdom. And you have been so good to us, and we count our blessings now as we think about this, and we just pray that you will help us so that we can be a help to those people out there that are just becoming, you might say, upset and all, and help us to give them the directions that they need. Because they need your help. The lies, the propaganda that we have been hammered with for so many years, we need to help people to correct and get them to deprogram their minds and get that out of the way and make that scripture that Christ left with us, know the truth, and the truth will make us free. And that's got to be our key, and that's got to be our goal, our motto, know the truth, and the truth will make us free. And I just believe that you would have that to be the way that this is done. And we just thank you now for everything, and we give you the praise for all that you have done and what you're going to do in the future, and we thank you. In Christ's name we pray. Amen.
Thank you, Red. Thank you, Kate. Thanks for making this a great show tonight, guys. See everyone next week on Walls in Our Minds.
You stood before creation, eternity in your hand, and you spoke the earth into motion. My soul now is new. You still be for my failure and carry the cross. Yeah. Lord.